November 10th, 1982. This is Kelly Reeve. And enough said.
Let's start. Your mom, Wisconsin?
Wisconsin,
And can you tell me any memories that you might have had about the grandmother, the women in the family, that had an effect on you? Did they work outside the home?
Oh no, and we had my grandmother and grandparents, my mother's parents lived with us until, well, you know, as long as they were there. And
well, you were growing up.
Yes, while I was growing up, and then.
Were you a farm family?
My mother's parents had come from Denmark. My father's family was. His father was a French Canadian that had come down into Wisconsin and married a gal that was from Pennsylvania, one of the old Yankee families there. In fact, I didn't find out until about 10 years ago that I was eligible for the DAR through her because one of my nieces had followed through. And so, I mean, it was typical American Midwest family, you know.
Did they work in a township or were
they? My mother's parents, my grandfather was a carpenter, and he started out when they first came over working in sawmills, and then he got into carpentry, finished cabinet making. And my father's father was a lumberjack, and he ran lumber camps. And that was how my father then ran lumber yards for him, retail outlets for what lumber he had made.
It was a family business.
Yes, on my father's side. My mother's side, he was a freelancer, so to speak, and she was a school teacher. And after she graduated from high school, then they got to teach school. And that was how she met my father.
Unless
they said
the women stopped teaching school
when
they got married?
Yes, mm-hmm. Unless they were widowed, and then they
married went back.
No.
Do you have any idea why that happened?
No. Well, it was just, the thing was that when you got married and you raised a family, you stayed home with a family. They didn't work outside the home, unless, as I say, they were widowed. They
what
were.
Of their child?
Well, then they'd go. Yes, but I don't think they did. They would be what you'd call substitutes. They'd be on call, you know, but not a regular full-time job. You know, thinking back, I don't know about anyone, I mean, married women working, because it was the thing the man provided, and the woman created the comforts for him. It wasn't working.
Was it your mother that went with you?
Yes, Grandma Billy.
Is she and the one that was born in Denmark?
Yes, yeah, they were both born in Denmark, and it was in 56 when Scandinavian Airlines first started their polar flights direct from, well, it started out from Los Angeles and went over the pole to Denmark, and Bob and I went and visited her remaining relatives over there, six cousins and things like that, and down in the southern part of Denmark. He was also a musician. He played the violin, and we had a piano in our house, and I learned to play the piano. I took about 3 months of lessons to learn which black note meant which key on the piano, and then he taught me to play the piano, and I went really into it. I mean, I got so I was real good at it. And my sister took up the cello, and my dad got a set of drums, and we had a little family orchestra, and then when I got into high school, why I played the drums in the high school orchestra.
Oh, well, excuse me, Sarah, your mother, didn't
she? 21, I think. Yeah, I think she was 22 when she had my oldest sister.
And yeah, how many children did she have?
The three girls. I was the youngest. And because there were only girls, when my dad made me the boy, I was the tomboy of the family. I did everything with him, you know.
Did you have a feeling that they felt deprived because
they
didn't have a son?
No, he was satisfied. I answered the need, you know.
Was your father, do you think your father had more influence on you than your mother?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
This idea that he made you his son,
I don't know. It's just that I knew how to do so many more things than my sisters, that hung around with mom. And I liked housework too. I enjoyed that. That's what girls did. When my kids were growing up, they got bicycles, they had earned themselves, and they said, come on, Mom, you ride a bicycle. And we never had bicycles. Girls didn't in those days. So. Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, my mother was very anxious that we'd be ladies, and so I was when I was around her, and I was a tomboy.
To be like a lady, what does that entail?
Oh, doing the things that
not
ladies. Yes, mm-hmm, yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Pick berries and, canned and cooked and learned how to wash and iron and,
So the presumption was that the daughters would be
home. Yes. Oh, yes. Definitely.
Did you have any heroes that you admired that you perhaps, as a child, reading books or films, did you have any ambitions to become something else than a housewife?
No, I don't recall, that I had a goal or wanted a career or wanted a family, or I don't recall. I just wanted to be doing things all the time, and that was why when I, we're talking about depression number two now, but the Great Depression was when I was growing up, and I had it all, but when I was 16, I made up my mind that I wanted to be a missionary because I had a crush on the assistant pastor in our church who eventually married my older sister. But anyway, I took my high school courses. I took 4 years of Latin and 2 years of French and to prepare myself for theological college. I was going to go to it was in Watertown, the Universalist University there, and that was what I was going to do. But then when I got out of high school at the age of 16, yes, I was an A student, and I was 2 years younger because I'd having the two older sisters, and they came home and taught school to the kid sister, that wasn't eligible yet. So I started school a year early. I started when I was five instead of six, first grade, and I skipped a grade, and when we had whether it be three classes in one room, one teacher, third, fourth, and fifth grade, where I did three and four in 1 year. She just moved me over into that class when they went on to that, when the third grade class was doing their homework or whatever, she'd take me on in the fourth grade. So I did third and fourth grade in 1 year, and so that put me at the age of 16, graduating from high school. Second in my class of 302. I can brag a little, can't I? My kids don't even know these things about me. Once in a while, I'll pop out with something. How did you graduate from school at 16? didn't know all this.
But he, and you thought perhaps that you would put your mind to work in shameless theology.
Yes, mm-hmm, yes, that was I was a great church goer, sang in the choir.
Did you feel a spiritual commitment?
Yes, I said I did. You know, I got up and said, I will give my life to Christ, and it didn't mean a darn thing to me. No. I just knew that that was what I was going into. And then, as I say, when the Depression hit and my dad was out of business, first the business he was in, real estate in Minneapolis at that time, why, then he drove cab and, you know, did anything to
your family
put food
was
on the
middle
table.
Class
yes,
before
mm-hmm.
the Depression hit.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Class,
yeah, mm-hmm.
And they did suffer from
it. Oh, yes, mm-hmm. Well, no, not suffer. I mean, we didn't, everybody else was in the same boat, you know. And,
you were affected.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, it meant that I wouldn't go to college. So then, meanwhile, my sister had married this assistant pastor, and they were over in Lansing, Michigan. And so, and when they had their first baby, they needed someone to babysit, you know, to help my sister, because she was active in the church with her husband. And so I went to live with them and went to business college.
In the theology school,
yeah, absolutely. There was no way of going away, you know, living away from home. So for my room and board, I mean, they're giving me a roof over my head and food on the table. I was made, you know, for my sister. And
how did you feel about this
community? No, it was a way of getting along. No, because I was in it, you know, living in a house with the minister, you know, I was involved in all the church work and everything, taught Sunday school, and, you know.
It was an easy compromise.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. You know, I don't think, we had frustrations in those days, really and truly, I don't. They hadn't delved into our minds to see whether we were disappointed or frustrated or, you know, I think, well, it's just because there's so darn many people around nowadays. I mean, you know, the concentration of population.
It sounds like you didn't have strong ambitions to do.
Well, I had to prepare myself to support myself,
mm-hmm.
you see. And then my dad and mother broke up. I mean, they separated. And
did this affect you?
Well, no, by then I was on my own, more or less. See, I was supporting myself in that I was working for my room and board, and I went to the business college and got out of that. It took me 18 months for the course. Gave me bookkeeping, typing, shorthand, you know, all the letter writing and, you know, all that sort of thing.
To make up, if you had become a secretary and a businesswoman and you married, could you still work in the office? Or is working
yes.
for women out for married women?
Well, all the girls, see, I went in, then I went to work for the insurance company in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. After I graduated and my sister didn't need me anymore, or I guess that was when they moved to Syracuse, New York. He was put into that church. And, my folks hadn't broken up then because they moved to Rochelle just out of Stevens Point. Yes, and I went there and got a job in Stevens Point, which was just 20 miles from home. It was after I was established in Stevens Point, and my older sister also got a job in this insurance company. And it was very low wages. It was a big insurance company, I think at the time, fifth largest in the United States, Hardware Mutual Casualty Insurance Company. And they had their home office, their headquarters, in a small community where they could get cheaper help for people who lived at home, you know. It was a business. It was a way of doing business.
This was
at
30. So
yeah, I was there 3 years.
Beginning of the
process. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And yes, it was 8 hours, 5.5 days a week. You work Saturday mornings to 8 to 12. 8 to 5 was an hour for lunch. And
when you say low wages, was everyone making low wages?
Yes, it was their standard. I mean, you know, if you wanted to make more money, you went to the city where they paid more, but then you had your expenses. You know, your expenses were more.
Did you feel fortunate that you found a job at all?
Yes. Mhm. I remember when I went to apply, and apparently they needed somebody in their statistical department, and because I was all called upstairs and asked Mr. Dimmock, could you use someone who is not experienced in your department, but I'm sure has the intelligence to learn. I remember his saying that. I must have impressed him favorably with my record, perhaps. But anyway, I went in there and I was for $65 a month, and with the understanding that I was on 2 months probation, and then if my work was satisfactory and they kept me, well, I would get a $5 raise. And at the end of the 2 months, they had moved me from one desk up to another one, I mean, you know, more important. And my paycheck came, and I looked at it, and it was exactly the same as it had been the past 2 months. So I went to my supervisor. I said, the agreement was, didn't I have nerve? When you think, you know... But he said, oh, well, I'll certainly talk to the personnel director about that. And by golly, the next paycheck I had...
You had a lot of self-confidence.
Yes, well, I was sure of myself. I don't know, unless my dad had maybe... You see, we didn't think along those lines at that time, but he must. Well, when I tried something, it worked. I mean, you know, and it just instilled. I didn't think of myself as being sure of myself. You know, that was.
Was that
unlikely? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, you were supposed to be the clinging vine type, I think. But I was just happy in what I was doing, and took pride in having things come out right. You know, I haven't talked about myself like this. I never have. Come to think of it, I never delved into the workings of my mind. that was how I came to Alaska. It was just that. I can't say I didn't have any fear. I guess I didn't know what fear was. I mean, you know. All these various things came to me. I have always figured, well, I read that someplace, you know. And I was taught now through reading or where, I don't know, that as long as you know about something, you don't have fear of it. It's only the unknown that you are afraid of. And the unknown, if you get to know it, well, then there's nothing to fear. And that started with, like, when there's a noise in the night. You know, and you think of all the things it could be. Well, go and find out what it was, and then it won't bother you anymore. And you know, this is true in life.
I know that we spoke about your mother's influence on your last story, and you mentioned that your mother had some aspirations that you thought were not realized.
Oh, yeah. Well, she...
seem to have a crush on you.
No, I didn't know that she had always wanted to go west until I said, I'm going to head for Alaska. And instead of saying, oh no, you know, that's, yes, well, and it's too dangerous or, you know, too far away and all that sort of thing. Instead, she said, oh, I hope you do. I always wanted to go west and never did. And, you know, and that was the first that I ever knew that she wasn't completely
happy.
Did
she instill in you a sense of your own confidence and anything you wanted to do and were capable of doing that you didn't want to
see? Maybe, subtly. I mean, you know, I wasn't cognizant of the fact that she was instilling. I think I just did it myself just by wanting to do something different, you know, and see whether it would work or not. Another thing, I was never, if something didn't come out right, I wasn't frustrated. I just accepted the fact that that doesn't work, you know. And in this spiritual thing, you know, my being, I was greatly influenced by Lloyd C. Douglas's book. You know, forgive me, my precious. They were fiction, but they were always made a point. You know, and as long as you are kind to, good to, for something, why you reap your just rewards. I mean, you know, it's the old fashioned, but works. You know, you just have faith in the fact that as long as you aren't doing anything to hurt anybody or destroy anything or, you know, as long as you take a positive approach toward things, why, you'll go forward. Otherwise, anything else will set you back.
Well, having a practical sense of the world, it appears to me. You said last time you looked at the women in your office one day.
Well, we used to sit around during lunch hour, and they were always going to marry a rich man and get to go to China or get to go to Mexico or South America or something. And it just didn't... I couldn't see depending... Yes, uh-huh. I couldn't see depending on getting married and having a man do that for me. I figured I could do it myself, which I did.
Did men play any role in your life at this point?
No. With having the two sisters, well, and the one that was with me then, Stevens Point, we were always in groups. And sometimes it was all girls, sometimes it was a couple of friends that we've known, Boy Scout camp was just out of town, and several of the fellows that we had known in the church in Minneapolis were involved in the Boy Scout movement, and they'd come down, conduct these camps, and they'd come and we'd go someplace together, you know, a movie or some, always Dutch, because nobody had any money. And
how about what we call... what do we call it? Sex preparation. Did you have any knowledge of boys?
No.
Did
they
ever talk to you about
that? No. And when we go out on dates, I don't recall her ever putting her hands on me or anything like that. I mean, you know.
Did your mother get
I wasn't sexless. No. I just don't know. It wasn't on our minds. When I see all these panels and everything, Donahue shows, you know, and there was a gal on, I don't know, it was this morning, the Donahue show. Yeah, they were talking about pornography. And she said, what's all this emphasis on sex? I mean, you know, and I wonder why, too. It never was a part of, we knew where kittens came from, you know, and why they were there and that sort of thing.
You didn't know the mechanics of sex?
No. No, everything was...
What about
your living? Yes, I remember in this a small town, where my folks live, that the girl next door got pregnant. And, oh, we didn't even talk about it. And, you know, and we didn't speak to Lucille, you know, my mother, you know, it was not ladylike. How she had gotten into trouble, it never occurred to me. I mean, you know, it just that she was a bad girl. Because she was pregnant, and, you know, she was going to have a baby. That was what we called it then. And
well, if there was no discussion of sex, and there was no information, and yet when the girls experienced it and got pregnant, they were shunned. It seems to be a touch between. You knew whatever it was, you shouldn't be participating in it.
Well, you see, I just don't know. It never.
Well, it made your neighbor a bad girl.
Yes, but didn't. I wasn't told why she was. It was just that she was going to have a baby. Period. I mean, you know, not that she had had illicit sex with a boy. I mean, you know, I just didn't put two and two together, I guess. I don't know. Well, Mother said, well, she just kept to herself. I mean, but if she was sitting on the front porch when we'd come home, my mother would say, don't look, Lucille's out there. So we didn't look, I mean, you know. And why didn't I ask? Why? You know, because I always was a why. When my dad would be fixing something, I'd say, well, why are you doing that? And then he'd explain, you know, why I could
fix
the thing. No, apparently not. Well, maybe my mother's attitude, that there was something to shun. That's a good four-letter word that we don't use very often anymore. I like four-letter words. You know, work, help, give, you know. I gave a speech on that at ADAC High School, Bob Reeve High School, and I ADAC for their graduating class. I gave them a lesson in history and a lesson in English. And the first part was why the high school was named that, you know, and gave them for history. And I told them there'd be no test on that now, but I was going to give them an English lesson. And it's going to be four-letter words, and so going into that. I said, for instance, I'm a Dane. That's a four-letter word, and it tells you all you have to know about me. It means that I'm female and that I'm old. I said, the other speaker here is the senator, I said, is a four-syllable word. He's a politician, and that doesn't tell you a thing about him until he gets to make a speech. I have fun with four-letter words. That's why I made that sampler. Bells, that's zinging, song, sing, life, live, love, give. I mean, you know, you say a hell of a lot with four-letter words. four-syllable words, they get too complicated. There's nothing specific about them.
Let's get you back to the decision on coming to Alaska.
Well, it was a fantasy, a dream, that was what I would do. And I thought, well, why not?
Where did the dream come from?
It just not wanting to do what the other girls.
Well, why Alaska?
Because it was a place nobody had ever heard of.
Did you read books about it?
I went to the library, and there were two books on Alaska. And I've been trying to remember the name of that one book. I knew the author's name was Stevens. And because I wanted to write to a secondhand bookstore or someplace and find it. Because it told about that there was farming in the valley. I mean, they grew strawberries and that sort of thing. I just knew it wasn't all ice and snow. And the other was Uncle Sam's Attic, which was written by, gal made the trip up to Nome and on the boat and all that. And it gave me just enough taste, so that I thought, well, in the century of progress, the World's Fair was in Chicago that year, when I went down and looked at, saw the Alaska exhibit, which was nothing but a little log cabin with a bunch of pictures and a pair of snowshoes and, you know, the different things that were used up here. And Slim Williams with his dog team that had made the run down from Copper Center of Alaska down into the States and ended up at the World's Fair. And he told me about it, and I subscribed to the newspaper that was printed in Seattle. They had a copy of it there with news from all over Alaska. So I subscribed to that, and I made up my mind that I was going to save. I had just paid off. I had had to borrow $150 to go to this business college, and I paid that off, $150 plus $18 interest in that year and a half. 2 years it was, because it took me that long to pay it off after I got my job. And I, I subscribed to the paper.
Even going to the exhibition.
Oh, yes. Because I thought it was going to take me 2 years to save up enough money to make the trip. But while I was saving this money and putting it away and reading this Alaska Weekly newspaper and everything, I figured it would take 2 years. And then I got anxious. And so I doubled what I was putting away and went without lunches, spent my time in the library. You know, what I chose to read was the Koran. You know, that was the way I spent my lunch hour, so I wouldn't be hungry. And maybe that kind of helped me, too, with this faith business. I mean, I don't know. But anyway, I finally had saved up the amount, and I had done it in 1 year instead of 2 years. So in 34, I...
Did you think of it as a trip instead of a...
No, I thought of it as going there, you know, going there. Yes, mm-hmm, to stay. Everything was so static there in Wisconsin. I mean, you know, we had begun to climb out of the Depression and that sort of thing, and I was earning more money. That was why I could put more away. But I knew there was something more to life than just getting married and having a family, which is what the others were doing, or else just staying at the same job and earning more money. You know, what to do with it? Go to another World's Fair? So anyway, I wrote two letters. I wrote one to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, because that was in the interior, and then I wrote one to Pilot R.C. Bob Reeves in Valdez, because it would tell about his making trips to Chittenah and making a trip to Anchorage and to Seward and Fairbanks and McGrath, you know, the mining camps and all that. And so I wrote to him and the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, told them what my qualifications were and, you know, what I could do, and asked if they thought there would be any work available for me. And I got an answer from both of them. And Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce said they didn't know of any particular job that I could come to, but they were sure there would be something in my line of work that I would get a job. And Bob said the same thing. He didn't know. I went in my letter to him. I said, I see where you go to these various places, and maybe you could find out if there were a job open. Well, he wrote back the same thing, that he didn't know of any specific job, but that he was sure that with my background that I would find something to do. Could have been the court system or, you know, anything like that, or, you know, store bookkeeping in a store or whatever. Yes, the big district court building was there. Well, anyway, when I got to town, my...
Garcia.
The to Valdez. Oh, excuse me. I headed for Valdez. That was, you see, it was at the end of the road, the terminus of the road into Fairbanks. And I thought if I don't find anything when I get to Valdez, I didn't want to go to Southeastern. That was too close to the States, you know. I wanted to go into the real Alaska. Still is. I'm provincial. And if I couldn't find anything there, I could go up the on a truck or whatever and go into the interior. And then that was a distribution point for all the mining camps and that sort of thing. Other small towns.
How did you get from Wisconsin?
By bus. Took 3 days to Seattle. And then, that's another little item. When I got to Seattle, the longshoremen were striking. And the boat that I was to sail on the following Wednesday didn't sail. And there wasn't a boat for 3 weeks. So I was stuck in Seattle for 3 weeks with my money pinned inside my brassiere. And I didn't want to delve into it because I wanted to land there. I had all my tickets paid for, and I wanted to land there with enough to buy a ticket back in case I... when I left the insurance company, I told them I was quitting, and they said, no, take a leave of absence because it isn't going to work out. In 6 months, you're going to want to be back here. And I said, well, okay. I grudgingly took a leave of absence, you know, no pay. But the job would, that way the job would still be open for me when I came back. Well, the reporters there in Seattle were getting stories on how the strike was affecting people. And I had gone to the Alaska Weekly office there in Seattle and got acquainted with Lulu Fairbanks, the gal that had a column in the paper and everything, and she kind of took me under her wing and showed me. Just to let them know that it was because of reading their paper that I felt confident in going to Alaska.
Did you say you were an outgoing personality?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wasn't. I wouldn't say bold, but unafraid. It's just one of those things. And so then she took me up to, I've forgotten, some ad agency, and Mr. Stang, she introduced me so that I could have a view of the city from his office, and he took me out to a nursery that he had an interest in. He wanted to check on how the flowers were doing at the nursery and all that sort of thing. And it was either one of them that must have referred this reporter that I was there waiting for the strike to be over so I could go to Alaska. And so this reporter came and interviewed me to see how I was being affected. And I said, I hope it's over pretty soon or I'm not going to have enough money left. I've got my ticket paid for. I can get there all right, but I want to be able to hold onto myself, once I do get there, until I get a job. And that was in the paper, my picture, and one of the gals that had known my sister back in Stevens Point, she and her husband had moved out to Seattle, and she saw that in the paper, recognized the name, and called me and said, are you Shirley's sister? And I said, yes. And she said, well, this is Marita Stevens, and she said, you better come and stay with us. No telling how long this strike will last. And so I went and stayed with them as their guest, And
I love that you had kind of initiated.
Well, yes, Now, if I'd refused to see the reporter, I found out about nickel lunches. That was one of the things that we haven't had so far in this depression that we had then. But there were these places, they called them the nickel lunch. And it was a counter, and there you could get a roll for a nickel, and pineapple and cottage cheese salad for a nickel. Each item was a nickel, so you could have 10 cents worth of lunch or 25 cents, however much you had. And I got by on 10 and 15 cent lunches until Marita called me. I'd forgotten how many days it was that I was on my own there in the Savoy Hotel. And
tell me about Lily Fairbanks, because I know she's well known.
Yes, she
what was she doing during this time?
Well, and she was something else on the paper. I've forgotten what, maybe like women's editor or, you know, something like that. She
she's
was on the staff.
With Alaska, she's
yes, she had, I think she only made a couple of trips up here. Personally, but she always visited with everyone coming through from Alaska off the boats, you know.
So she didn't spend any time in the state.
No.
But she didn't know.
No.
At least at this time.
She had visited up here, but not to live here.
The only way into Alaska then was by boat.
Yes.
There was no commercial
flying. No, the planes wouldn't fly that far. I mean, you know, between.
So I assume you finally got a boat.
It was 3 weeks after the strike lasted 3 weeks, and then I got on the Yukon, and because it was the first boat after 3 weeks, why they stopped at every cannery. It took me 8 days to get to Valdez. I think it was a regular boat that would hit just the big towns. Would take 5 or 6 days, I think. But anyway, we stopped at every little cannery. It was like the railroad does, you know, every little bridge and everything else to pick up people at the market. And it was to bring the freight to them. Various places.
What's your first impression?
Well, the first thing was that I was riding on a big boat. I had always been not afraid of, but uncomfortable on water in lakes, you know, like crossing the Great Lakes and things like that. But this was the Inside Passage, and I felt as if I could just, I would always be able to swim to that shore. You know, I was always within sight of land. So that was the first thrill. It was traveling on a big boat with meals and cabin and recreation, dancing and all that sort of thing. And then seeing these towns as I came to them. Each of them was just like when we hit Petersburg and Wrangell and Juneau and Sitka. In those places, we all got off the boat and walked around town, and I was just sightseeing. But when I got to Valdez and got on that dock, and oh, it was all clouded over, but it was the longest day of the year. I mean, it was daylight. And that long dock up to where the town was and everything, and for some reason or other, now here I am, I'm home. It was, it was just a thing that came over me. Here I am. Good.
Well, it had been over a month, just about a month, right?
Yeah.
Since you left home.
Yes.
It must have been a
sense of relief. Yes, I made it, and I still have my money.
and
then...
You have your one contact in Valdez, and it was me.
Yes. He'd left town.
Yes. I understand he left town on purpose.
Yes, He didn't want to be responsible for anybody.
But he called a friend to meet you.
Yes, mm-hmm. But on the boat coming up, you know, when you're 8 days with a group of people, while you get to know them, and then you know where they're headed and all this and that. And Fanny and Charlie Fisher, who had the restaurant in Valdez, were coming home from their trip outside, and they invited me to come and stay with them while I was looking for a job. And of course, in a small town like that, the word gets around in a hurry. And
there weren't very many single women in the town.
No, just Anna May, which was clerk of the court, and Mima Ellis was the judge's secretary, and then the school teacher, well, the school teachers had gone by the time I got there. They always came for the school year and then went out, unless they'd gotten married and stayed. So, they were
there. There's a quote in the book that says that after you married me, somebody says, well, now there's two single women from
eating them. Yes, uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, that's the way it was. But anyway,
were you aware of this at the time?
No, I wasn't looking for a man. I was looking for a job so I could keep going. And yeah, Bob always said that the only girls who came were husband hunting. You know, the school teachers, and nurses were husband hunting. And
I think that's a fair statement.
Well, a lot of them got married. And. The men were so glad when they came. I mean, you know, they had some of the meals for them. That was their clothes.
What kind of job did you
find? Well, then the Earl Simmons at the Road Commission Office, what's now the Public Highway Department or whatever, was the Alaska Road Commission. And their main offices were in Juneau. And then they had these camps along the highway, and the district office was there in Valdez, and Earl Simmons, who was the bookkeeper and warehouse man and everything there in the main office, needed help. But their policy was to hire only men because it was seasonal work, and if they hired a woman, well, she'd get married and leave the job and all that. So they only hired men. But he asked me if as long as I could do the work. I mean, you know, I was a bookkeeper and everything. Well, he needed help, and so he put me down on the payroll thing as warehouse man, and used just my first initial, JB, so that they wouldn't know I was female. My name, real name Janice, would give it away, and so it got by, and I got my $6 a day, or 5 days a week. And boy, that was good money.
Were you at all curious about this Mr. Reed that you wrote to? And
oh, yes. Well, of course, on the boat, I'd asked, what's he like and all that sort of thing. And he's a pilot, they're very glamorous and romantic and all that, but he's a bachelor, strictly single guy. And then, of course, when I got there and he wasn't there, so what? I got a job and I was working, and that's where he named me Tilly, was when he did come back to town about 10 days or 2 weeks later. I've forgotten how long my... Dr. Wise, that he had asked to meet me, ran up when he landed and said, "That girl is here." And he said, "How is she?" And he said, "Oh, she's cute. She's got a job, too." "Oh, well, that's fine." I mean, then Bob would come into town because I already...
You thought you were going to be dependent on him?
Well, he just didn't... because he had said that, he figured he was going to have to get me a job because he had said that he was sure there would be one.
Do you remember your first meeting with him?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Owen Meals, that had the garage and things at the airport, mechanics shop. He and his wife, who had been a school teacher that had married Owen and was now the postmistress there in Valdez, invited me up to dinner and invited Bob to dinner too. That night. I knew he had come into town, and he knew what I looked like because he had walked by the Road Commission office, and I was sitting there, as he says, punching the typewriter, and I looked just like Tilly the Toiler in the funny papers. And so he just called me Tilly after that. But anyway, when I went up to the Meals house that night for dinner, he was already there, and when I came in, everybody in town was so sure, because he had come from Wisconsin and I was from Wisconsin, that I was some girl chasing him. I mean, they just took that for granted in this town. And so when I walked in, why, of course, he got up, and Nancy and Owen didn't introduce us at all. They just figured we knew each other. And so he said, "You're Miss Morissette?" And I said, "Yes." "And you must be Mr. Reed." And we shook hands and got acquainted. So then he invited me up to the field while he was working on his aircraft, and I helped him just like I had helped my dad. He told me he was 10 years older than he was, and it didn't make a bit of difference. I mean, you know, I couldn't have cared less. I just knew that that was the one I was going to be with. I didn't know whether we'd ever get married or
anything. It was very attractive to me.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You were creating a life for yourself as a single woman?
Well, yes. I, you know, paying my own way.
Did you have any loan things?
Oh, yes. You mean in Valdez there?
Valdez.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, Anna Mae and Nima and I, you know, and then when the school teachers came, why, we'd have our little card parties, and oh, we even formed what we call the Optimist Club. It was six gals, yes. And
so there were six women there that were working on.
Well, that was when the school teachers came too. Two in the court, and then the school teachers, and I was the oddball. Oh, when the road season ended, see, they just shut everything down the 1st of October. And then, so that office didn't need me anymore. Why, by that time, the telephone operator, they needed a, they always had two. You worked 12-hour shifts, and changed every 2 weeks. And Pearl Ecamo and I were the two telephone operators, and I worked the winter in the telephone.
Did you notice that Valdez didn't seem to be suffering from depression because
the thing is that Alaska at that time was always depressed, you know, well, really and truly. Everything was so seasonal, and the miners would come in and work the season and go out. The road workers would work for the season and go outside again. You know, the few families that were there, well, one was a miner who had his own little operation, and just his boys worked in it, the Johnson family. And the mercantile store, was groceries and hardware and that sort of thing, and the bank, and a restaurant, Charlie and Fanny Fisher's restaurant, Merchant's Cafe, they called it, and the dock company that handled all the boats and the freight and that sort of thing, and the school teachers and the superintendent of schools. The school was a married man with a family, and they, in order to keep busy during the summer, put up a little cafe type thing, not a restaurant with meals, but a hamburger stand, actually, you know, had pie and that sort of thing. And I'm trying to think. Oh, and then, these are the people that lived there the year round. Oh, and Fred Colclaw had a metal shop, metal worker shop. And Bernie Whalen had a dairy, I mean, a cow, and the butcher shop. I mean, he had milk from his cow, and then the butcher shop, which was all frozen meat.
How many would you say for the family?
About 250 to 300, around that. And then in the summertime, why, of course, it burgeoned.
Have you seen any natives on the community?
Yes, they didn't live in Valdez. They would come in from Tepetlik down the sound, and from the interior in the summertime from Copper Center. Those were Indians, and the ones on the coast were Eskimos.
Mm-hmm. Did they mingle at all with the
Well, they weren't there in the wintertime, you know, when, and in the summertime, they'd come in and get their supplies and everything. That was what helped the community get going. But they didn't stay there, you know, they just came in for supplies and beer, get drunk. Bob would take them up for sightseeing trips. They'd want to fly over Elamar, you know, their hometown. They still had some money left from their fishing. After the wives would always get all the supplies they needed and clothes for the kids and that sort of thing, and then if there was any money left over, well, the men blew it on beer and airplane rides.
They weren't economically more depressed than
your wife. No, because they fished, and or the ones from the interior with their traps, their furs and that sort of thing. No, none of them was in business, but they were.
But the native women,
living
they, I understand, they housework for white women.
Not in Valdez. No, mm-mm. No. They when they were in town, they went to, yes. Mm-hmm.
And then they left.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they went back with their families.
If I'm not jumping ahead of this story, mm-hmm. I understand you left
in California. Yeah, uh-huh. I, after that first year.
You stayed a year?
Yes, uh-huh.
You had a friendship with Mr. Reed?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
And you were disappointed on that?
Well, yes, uh-huh. He was a bachelor, period. I mean, he didn't, believe in marriage and I could see where I wasn't, that I might get into trouble. And so I thought,
were you leaving Alaska?
You know, I was going away.
You were, in your mind, you're going to return?
Well, as soon as I got out there, I knew I was going to come back. I mean, I couldn't stand it. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So as soon as I wrote to this insurance company that had a branch office in San Francisco. I didn't want to get too far away. I only had enough money to get that far. And because I was just barely making, I mean, what I earned, I had to spend to live. I mean, you know, it was just a matter. It was all even. And so I wrote to that insurance company and asked if they had a position open and told them about my background experience and all that. And he wired right back and said that they did have an opening in their accounting department.
Jobs
there.
Jobs for you seems enormously easy.
Well, I know. Uh-huh. I just happened to have the right qualifications where I looked, I guess. And the luck of it that they did have an opening. And of course they were anxious to get someone with background experience in the company as opposed to having to train someone, you know. I mean, here I could just step into a job because I knew what it was all about and was familiar with their system and all that sort of thing.
How long did this trip take? It was short-lived.
It took me 10 months to save enough to come back to Alaska. Meanwhile, I had written to Warren Taylor, he was the U.S. District Attorney in Cordova, and I had written him to see if he knew of any jobs in the court system. I figured that would be where I would get back in, you know, from a distance and having been here and all. And he wrote that there wasn't anything in the open in the court system, but that the Chittenden Hotel was getting ready to open up for the summer. See, everything was seasonal. And he said that they could use a reservations clerk, that the one that they'd had for years was either died or forgotten or what, wasn't going to be coming back. And so I came to that job.
You've been writing to Mr. Reed?
Oh, yes. Well, he was writing to me oftener than I was writing to him. Every time a boat left Valdez, there was a letter on it for me. And that was all I survived on in San Francisco. My sister came out and worked with me too. I mean, lived with me. We had an apartment together, And she didn't like it either, because she'd fallen in love with one of these Boy Scout executives, you know, back in Illinois. And so we just lived very frugally. Every payday we'd go down to Chinatown and have a Chinese dinner and go down and buy a pair of hose or whatever we needed, and the rest of it went into the, you know, the kitty to get out of there. Not that I knew of. I mean, you know, he had been writing me, but just telling what was going on and experiences that he'd had and that sort of thing. Still got all the letters in the closet. My oldest daughter got that. She, when we went in there to look for some records or something, she said, "What's this box?" And I said, "Oh, those are all your dad's letters that he wrote me when I was in San Francisco. Could I read them?" And she got the biggest kick out of it. There was never any kind of a commitment of any kind. It was just keeping contact. So then I just let him know that I was coming back. I had a job in Chittenden. And I was there about, what, a week, 10 days, maybe 2 weeks. And he had flown into Copper Center, and then he had to go by car into Chittenden at the time. And came down to see how I was doing. The hotel wasn't open yet. We were just getting it all ready and everything. And the gal who was to have charge of the kitchen, and I was in charge of reservations, and then there was somebody else. But anyway, the railroad crew that was repairing the bridge on the railroad, they had started their work, and they would come in to the hotel where the bar was and have a beer. And so the three of us, there wasn't a bartender as such because this wasn't open, so we were pouring the beer for these construction workers on the railroad. When Bob saw that, he said, "You're not going to stay here. You're not a barmaid." I said, "Oh, no, I'm a reservations clerk, but we don't have any rooms ready yet." He said, "You come back with me." He just hauled me right out of there. I don't know who they got for a reservation.
Do you think he was serious, or was just a reason that he could have served himself? Did he really feel that women that served drinks were in the fallen
women? No, he just knew I didn't belong there. He was going to see to it that I got out of that job. And then he took me over to Anchorage here, and, so that I could look for work.